Welcome back to Beyond the Signal, where we cut through the buzzwords and talk real-world cybersecurity and AI with the leaders on the front lines. In this episode, I'm joined by Tony Terry, Senior Director of Information Technology at one of the country's leading academic medical institutions. We talk about AI governance, medical data privacy, hybrid infrastructure strategy, and why ChatGPT probably shouldn't be your family doctor just yet. From balancing academic freedom with compliance to turning AI panic into practical policies, this conversation is candid, smart, and even a little funny. If you've ever worried that your job might be replaced by a bot, or worse, a bad dashboard, this one's for you. Let's dive in. Tony, thank you so much for joining us today. It's so great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
To start off, AI is everywhere right now. Boards, vendors, even the nightly news. At a very large university, you're managing multiple constituencies with wildly different agendas. When you hear the phrase AI hype, what's the first myth you feel compelled to debunk internally?
Well, sure. I'm glad Katie used the term AI hype because, you know, AI hype is the same as Bitcoin hype and blockchain hype. I mean, we can roll back every 8 to 12 years and there's something. So when I hear AI hype, it's 2 years now since ChatGPT announced that their version, I think 3, was out and it can do so many amazing things. And on the backs of that, and I will answer your question, and on the backs of that, it was NVIDIA stock went up. Anything tied to generating AI, the initial hype, which still is starting to fizzle out a little and people are realizing the actual usage here, is the original hype was it's going to replace all the IT jobs. While it can at some point, let's remember, we're still at infant stage. So the hype to me is that people think we're here already. We're at Terminator 2 or any movie that you can imagine where AI has, you know, defeated the humans, which, you know, it could easily, I'm sure. But the point where it'll remove jobs. And again, we've had automation too in the past 10 years. So let me take pause because I think I answered your question with that's what AI hype is to me, that it's going to replace everybody's job.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of the things that people are really using AI for anyway right now, it's like writing your college essay, but the thinking of it taking away entire jobs, that's, I don't think it's quite like the supermarkets where you've got self-checkout, where it's going to come in and people are going to be like, oh no, all of our jobs are going to go away, right?
Well, there's a good correlation between self-checkout and AI, so I'm glad you brought that up, Katie. Self-checkout, I like it. Some people don't like it, right? It's a mixed bag. I like it because I just, boop, 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 you know, and I have my stores that I rate in my head which ones have the best self-checkout. But you still need someone there to assist when things go wrong. And that person on the AI world is AI governance. You're still going to need people to manage the process. There will come a day when AI will become self-governing. I don't know that I want to be alive for that day, but that time will happen at some point. Things improve. Things get better.
So on the other hand, what's one AI capability that you're already budgeting for because the business case is undeniable, even if the technology is not fully mature yet?
Right. Well, sure. Certainly, we have an agreement with ChatGPT and of course, Microsoft, where I work now, because we're a Microsoft shop. So theirs is called Copilot. We've tested 4 or 5 of the big ones, as you would imagine. ChatGPT was the first that was head and shoulders above, and it was willing to sign compliance agreements that, where I work, were required. So we already commissioned that for basic use, like you just hinted at, not for people doing term papers, but for use that maybe we can, we're testing. And again, I'm sure there'll be questions about this, but you have to test the living daylights out of these things and in a safe environment, almost like you put it in a box and test your data there, because this thing, if left untethered or set up incorrectly, will put your data out into the wild. It is a search engine, basically, much more robustly.
Yeah, I think it kind of relates along the lines of when DeepSeek came out and everybody was like, wow, this is amazing, the reasoning, the rationale, but not many people thought about, holy moly, I just dumped in a bunch of personal information right into this untested brand new AI. And what, not even a week later, they came out with, this is not safe. A lot of your information is completely unsecure at this point. Along the lines of budgeting, universities run on razor thin margins. Mm. How do you evaluate your AI investments when cost savings may be opaque or downstream, especially compared with, say, funding more faculty or student programs?
Right. Well, what you do, and you're right, academic institutions are razor thin margins. And even prior to what's currently in the news, they've always been that way, unless they get research grants that give them X amount of dollars, but that's usually carved out for a certain niche. You have to find the use case. You have to sell it to leadership. You have to show the return on investment. If we're going to spend $1 million, well, then we better make $1 million and 1 cent back on that investment, because then it makes it worthwhile, especially in the academic and medical institutions. You know, again, you're always postulating when you do that, but you're doing so in a very educated manner. And that's how it's accomplished at my level. And I think a lot of companies now that aren't academic or aren't just medical, they're all very, very tight budgets right now.
So for those non-technical budget owners, have you found any metrics or frameworks that resonate with them to justify AI spend?
Sure. How can it bring in more revenue? That's their metric. How can this add more revenue? Now, add more revenue for them, and a lot of companies, is add more revenue by removing staff. You know, how can we remove staff by using this tool? And for some AI things, I mean, it's not really quite there yet. I do think, like, to give you an example, I think analytics is going to be one of the first IT areas to be hit by AI. You'll still need analytics people, but you'll need a lot less of them, because AI is going to be able to, that's what AI is. It's basically like a gigantic SQL database that uses a large language model, and it uses a file that's called the parameter file. And that parameter file can now have millions of words, where years ago it was just maybe 1 million words. Well, those words become contexts, and there's a lot more nuance into how they tokenize the words. They give words like number meanings, and they match up or anticipate what Katie might be saying or trying to say, and fill in your blanks, and, you know, rewrite people's resumes or term papers and whatever have you.
You still have to have that oversight, because hallucinations, I could ask, and I have multiple times, because for some reason my 6th graders math is so much harder than it was when I was in 6th grade. It's like I didn't go to 6th grade almost at this point. You know, it can hallucinate, give you the wrong answer. You ask it the exact same way twice and you've got two different numbers. And so the human oversight is so important. Academic environments prize openness, but that openness can clash with security baselines. How do you strike the right balance between accessibility for researchers and the growing regulatory demands around data privacy?
It is challenging. And again, it goes back to what I said. You have to, first you create the AI governance, which where I work, they did. They had very high level people create AI governance policies. And a lot of facilities are doing it, because that's the only way to do it. You create your governance and policies first. For medical facilities that have researchers, it gets challenging, because the researchers are just champing at the bit. They want to get out there. They want to use this tool. And that's fine. So my recommendation is give them that tool, but you create that tool with your, you know, create the credentials of how they have to log in. And then that tool exists in a silo, meaning it's not open on the internet. So whatever they're putting in there, but you need to maintain governance, which is still evolving, right? People, you need to really be on top of what people are putting in that AI tool, which ChatGPT is very popular. Obviously, Google has Gemini. I'm not trying to leave anybody out. And Grok has gotten very good, which I believe is Twitter, or now it's called X. Their AI has gotten very good as well. So all these AIs are evolving. You have to control the governance, I'll go back to. And again, you have to have security parameters in place that can scan your network to see when rogues – I hate to use the term rogue, but it's people that are just so excited to use a tool, they're going to, regardless of what you want to do. And you have to catch them and say, you're violating company policy. You know, for medical institutions, if patient information gets out there, that's a HIPAA breach. And that will cost you millions of dollars in fines. And then there's about 3 to 5 years afterwards that you have to file a compliance to get back compliant again. They make sure that you're monitored over those years.
Thinking about the 23andMe going bankrupt thing, where everyone's like, go delete your information. I'm like, well, first, I want to download my information, because I'd like to see it. And then my brain is like, well, I don't have anyone I can just hand this to and go do it. I'm like, why don't I just give ChatGPT my raw DNA and have them tell me what's wrong with me? Which is a huge thing, I think, now in healthcare, is a lot of people trying to figure out, like, you know, doctors don't have as much time to spend going through every single thing going on with you and putting those pieces together. So it's a lot of, like, attempting to self-service. I don't think a lot of people realize what they're putting out there when they put their information in there.
No, they don't. But you've given an example of what AI can do in the medical field. You know, there's workflow automation that's already existed. Like one of the largest electronic health record is Epic, and then there's Cerner, and then there's certainly McKesson, but Epic's large. But a lot of them now have like tools where the patient's in the system, it sees all the patient's prior visits and the medications the patient's taking, and it sees the current symptoms for this current visit. So it will use some algorithm to say, well, this is how the patient should be treated. But I think AI is going to be able to take that a step further. And that's one of the things a lot of medical institutions are testing now is how can we incorporate this AI so we can use natural language for the doctors to just speak to AI and say, this is my patient, or here's my patient. You don't even have to say anything. You can just, it's going to link it. What do you recommend for this patient at this time? Or what problems do you see? AI is going to be able to detect problems that are coming based on these symptoms and the proper treatment now. Again, we're not there yet. This isn't Brave New World where we're there, where it's going to diagnose for you. But that's the medical next step for AI, in my opinion, based on colleagues I speak to at other facilities and just things I read and see.
Absolutely. I mean, maximizing the time that doctors have and the efficiency that they have to reach diagnosis, the lives that it can save is uncountable.
And also making sure that people don't get prescriptions, misprescriptions, because you can prescribe something to someone that could kill them because they could be allergic to something or they can have a pre-existing condition where they should not have this particular medication. It can help avoid those altogether. You want to be at 100%, and sadly, the world is not.
Can you share an example of where compliance requirements actually accelerated an innovation instead of slowing it down, which kind of, I feel like, can happen sometimes? You know, testing is supposed to make things safer, but
it's hard to say that compliance and policies accelerate the use of the product. I think they are almost always rushed because they know people are going to use the product. But in this case, like where I work and at a few other facilities, the process was the same. We saw it coming. Everybody was asking for it. They said, hey, I want ChatGPT. And we're like, we don't have it yet. But we know they're using it anyway, right? Because you could just go on the website and use it in some base form. We blocked it until we signed an agreement with them. They signed compliance things. But along that time, or during that time, we had compliance policies built, shared with the whole landscape of the company, and everybody now knows what the process is. But I really don't know in my career that I know of any policy that was created before people adopted the product. It was usually that they want to use this product, but we better hurry up, and now we had to create a policy. So yes, the policy was first. It always should be. You strive for that. A lot of times you find out, especially at a very large company, people get ahead of you, so you have to hurry up and catch up.
And you know, it's kind of like stops, or like new stop signs, right? Or like deer crossing signs. Until there are enough incidents, there's enough instances to make your case for why we should implement this or what we should do about it. It's, you know, you kind of have to wait until it becomes a thing. I wanted to use warning labels on bleach bottles as an example, but truthfully, the fact that that had to be a thing just blows my mind, because children can't read. So it had to be an adult. Truthfully.
Always. It's always an adult. It's always someone who doesn't think, yeah, don't drink bleach or don't put your hand on the stove. You know,
don't
like
spray
that,
the Windex in your eye.
You know, do it. You'll find out once and then you won't do it again. Yeah.
Hopefully.
Well, right. If you do it twice, well, that's natural selection. Yeah.
So your infrastructure spans on-prem networks, cloud workloads, SaaS tools, and countless endpoints. Without naming any vendors, what operating model helps you keep detection and response cohesive across that sprawl, especially when budgets and staff are fixed? Sprawl.
A hybrid model definitely works best, but more so, I think you want to have as much in the cloud as you can because you have a lot more redundancy there. As far as the detection, now, like I know for us, we're currently looking at like an open source dashboard tool that would manage all of our cloud networks and even our on-prem stuff. So that detection you're talking about, from a security standpoint, where do we have weaknesses? Like all the big tools like AWS and Google and Microsoft, and I'm sure some of the others, they have like their own dashboards. Hey, you have a security weakness here. This is wide open to the internet. Well, those rules can be customized where you can say, well, we don't want this AI tool in this bucket of servers or web file sharing apps or Kubernetes. So you can put rules in there. But I find that, you know, if you're a large organization, a dashboard that you can purchase, and again, that takes planning as well, that can look at all of your tools and give you alerts in real time and send email alerts when necessary, because no one's going to just sit there and stare at it all day. You want to automate as much as you can. And a lot of these tools are really comprehensive. Now, they all are. You can, and I don't want to give a vendor name because I don't want to give, you know, unpaid advertising, but like it can automatically shut down an endpoint that has a significant weakness. And that I like.
So when it comes to that, almost kind of like a symptom, seeing a signal is one thing, but deciding that it matters is another. How do you triage alerts so that your analysts focus on the 1% that really do need human investigation?
Well, it depends on what alerts are important to you. Obviously, security alerts like breaches and weaknesses and sharing data, open ports. We work closely with the security team when we build out. And when we build any kind of cloud offering, whether it be like an EC2 instance if it's AWS or Workspace or things like that, we make sure that we have compliance we have to follow. And security manages and also monitors the security dashboard of our respective clouds right now as we're working towards maybe getting a unified cloud monitoring system. So you meet with your teams, you find out what's important, but most of them are garden variety and very, very similar across different industries. There are just things that are important to you. You're going to get alerted on it all anyway, even if it was remediated automatically. And then there are some things where you have people on call for certain things that might need human intervention. And those things are decreasing as the months go by.
Good. That's good. That's progress, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
oh, yeah.
What is the most useful small-scale AI or ML experiment that your team has run inside of SecOps, one that didn't need a seven-figure platform to validate your ROI?
Well, just the basic, like, you know, ChatGPT, Microsoft Copilot, those two. We're not using Gemini yet. You know, we're just in its base use for educational purposes and informational purposes. Again, because it was easier to adopt because we weren't putting any data in there. But again, it's still isolated to our network. So it, even though it'll go out there and grab information from the LLMs that ChatGPT built, that's really it, because the cost is like $300 a year per user, something like that, which it's a decent amount of money, but it's not the end of the world to just say, well, we want to give this to, you know, 20 of our IT users so they have it as a tool.
Yeah, absolutely. It's now giving it to every doctor and every student and everybody else, that would be probably insane. But
It's a toughie. It's a toughie.
Yeah, it's one of those things you got to like weigh the cost to benefit, knowing that they're probably going to log into ChatGPT on their phone eventually and ask a question. And hopefully it's just one that's not anything with PII in it. So looking ahead, is there a capability you would never let an AI system fully automate, or at least in the next 5 years? What keeps that firmly in the human judgment column?
In my opinion, as someone who's not a doctor, I would say patient care. Like, I wouldn't want to walk into an office and have to speak to a computer and then have it tell me what my care is. You know, people do that. They will go on any of the AI tools and say, I'm having this symptom. And I don't even look up when anything hurts. I don't want to know, you know, but some people do. And they'll go, like, it used to be WebMD, which seemed like so long ago, but really it was probably just up until 7 years ago. But now it's the AI tools. Or maybe it used to be, hey, Google, right? That people would ask Google what was going on with them. Or, you know, Siri, you know, to be fair. So now it's whatever AI tool they have access to. And I've tried interesting things. You know, I've asked ChatGPT, Copilot, the same question, and I've gotten the same exact answer. And then a couple of the others, I got different answers. So it is interesting. I don't know that I want each of them giving me the same exact answer. That tells me they're tied to the same small bucket. So again, we're not there yet. And so I wouldn't trust healthcare solely to be automated yet. That's what I'm saying. I think there will be a time when it's amazing. And sadly, I think that time's going to advance very quickly.
With AI shouldering more tier one tasks, how are you reskilling or retaining analysts who worry that the fun parts of their job may disappear?
Yeah, no, it's fun. Fun is even, it's scary. There's a lot of people that are analysts that are scared that their jobs in general are going to go away. And some of the low level, you know, tier one help desk jobs maybe could. So I think those are going to be the ones. But what you want to do then is train your people up so that they can be that next level. They can help build that tier one AI function. Like, for instance, ServiceNow is a major service ticketing tool for help desks. It's one of the bigger players. And they have a lot of things you can do in that system. It's a monolith, but not everybody builds it out the right way. I think they even have the opportunity for chatbots. I don't use that. But, you know, building those chatbots, which is essentially AI, like we see on everything we go on, like Amazon, if you're buying something anywhere, really. And that could be quite annoying. So you always need people behind it because sometimes the automation doesn't really hear you and sense that you need an answer that they can't give you. So the only thing you can do is train people to manage them up because there are some jobs that are going to be lost. However, to comfort people, I will say over the past 30 years, because that's really when the internet really exploded and went from the internet being in everybody's house that more than just a dial up to 2007, where you had Twitter and the iPhone. 2010, the iPhone 4 really changed a lot of things because it was probably their best iPhone, and people started having data plans with more data, and Wi-Fi was attached, and unfortunately the camera on the phones. So things really advanced greatly. A lot of jobs were lost, right? A lot of jobs changed that don't exist anymore, but other jobs come in their place. So there will be a lot of different things. What they are, I don't know. Wish I did, I'd buy stock.
We talk about that a lot at Gradient Cyber too, is AI and the future of a potentially fully autonomous SOC. But there will always have to be almost a puppeteer and a master of these agents helping teach them the right things to do and the ways to handle it and catching those issues. Because hopefully nowhere in the near future, like you said, will we be completely run by robots. I've seen iRobot too many times and I do not trust it. So
me neither, especially they look kind of creepy, but I did see that movie a few times.
Oh gosh, yeah, definitely creepy. And I don't even know if I'd feel okay with one that looked very human either, because that would be even worse, I think.
Yeah, like I saw a horror movie the other day, Meg, with like a little girl doll.
Yes.
Yeah, just the trailer scared me. I'm like, nope, I'm out.
Mm-mm, no, especially children. Like, no thank you.
No way.
My human kids scare me enough. I don't need a robot child.
Exactly.
So, universities attract top researchers. Are you partnering with academic departments to co-develop security or compliance solutions, or is that a church and state separation and it's still...
No, and it used to be excellent. Well put, Katie. It used to be church and state years ago, not too many years ago. But because like I had mentioned earlier in this podcast, researchers are, you know, listen, the brightest, right? We're lucky in this country. We have some incredibly bright researchers and they're off and running. But they understand that with AI, our governance comes first. And if you don't play by the rules, we will not give you the tools, and then other things may happen too. So, and I think a lot of facilities are doing that because they have to, because there's too much at stake here, too much information that can get out there in the wild. Patient information is one of them, sensitive information, which could vary.
The way you look at operations now versus how it used to be, where everyone had their own siloed department and essentially it was customer success, it was service, it was IT, it was this, it was that. I think it's completely changing as someone who spent most of her life working in operations. Like you see such a deeper level of collaboration and having to work really deeply with those other departments to make sure that the left hand knows what the right's doing and that they're not breaking something as they implement something new or try to fix something else too. For the wrap up, I want to do quick fire questions.
All right.
The first one is, I want you to complete this sentence. 2 years from now, AI will have eliminated blank headache for CISOs in higher ed.
Threat mitigation. That's a very, positive outlook, but I think threat mitigation.
That's a good, it's a good answer. It's made a huge difference already in the things that it can do.
Oh, definitely.
And especially on the detection side, you know, you find things so much more quickly than you used to, especially when it comes to cross-correlation across networks, endpoints, cloud, SaaS, finding those little, this happened here and this happened there. It's not just only endpoint detection or only network detection. So I completely agree. Okay, your second one. Which emerging regulation are you watching like a hawk?
Well, there's a few. There's a lot of federal guidelines just because of the work I do with the FDA. I would say guidelines on AI, just because of the U.S. and China, and that's regardless of who's president. You talked about it before with DeepSeek. You know, DeepSeek came out, and I read their white paper like everybody else did the second it came out, and I'm like, oh, wow, they did this for a fraction of the money. But really, they stood on the shoulders of the other AI tools. But then it wasn't safe. Like you said, we found that there's a lot of security restrictions. So I think AI governance for countries in general, I'm sure China has the same feelings about U.S., so they will definitely be locking down AI, because now that's really the new warfare would be through the cyberspace, especially with AI, where you can pretty much steal a ton of data in a nanosecond.
The attackers are using AI already. It's an AI and human connection. So to think that all AI or all human in cybersecurity could be a possibility, it just isn't. It's going to have to be a combination of those two. And because they're not going to stop trying to attack using both. So why would we stop defending that way?
No, it went from email to cell phones to now it's just going in so many other different ways, you know, trying to get your attention when you're on an app. You know, so.
Yep, absolutely. I get those really fun toll emails every day tolls.
Fantastic.
Driving me insane.
Yeah.
No, that's awesome. So I really want to thank you, Tony, for joining us. And I appreciate the time that you've spent with us. And I think that these answers have been, one, extremely insightful and will be super helpful for our listeners.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure. I appreciate it.
That's a wrap on this episode of Beyond the Signal. Huge thanks to Tony for dropping some serious knowledge and reminding us that good governance beats rogue enthusiasm every time. If you liked what you heard, be sure to follow us for more conversations with the folks building, defending, and sometimes herding the cats across modern security operations. And remember, AI might write your term paper, but it still needs you to read the footnotes. Catch you next time.